Essentially, this grew out of research I was doing. I didn't just go to the US for this, but I was in the US doing research for my book, my 2019 book, on community radio. And in the research for that book, I was trying to think what different kinds of community radio are there in US contexts. And as part of that, towards the end of it, I realized that I couldn't write a book on community radio in US contexts without incorporating Indigenous radio. And Indigenous radio itself has various names, right? So it is Indigenous, I think of Indigenous radio as produced by and for Indigenous communities. But then in the US, say this is also considered by those people as Native American radio, as Indian radio, as American Indian radio. So all these terms are in use. So when I say Indigenous radio, that's what I'm referring to. But a lot of practitioners on the ground might not even use that. But to your question, the book includes a chapter on three Indigenous stations. And when I started looking more closely at the provision of Indigenous radio, I realized there were something, and this number is still being discussed because people like me were trying to go to the stations on the ground to determine how many stations there were. And it's been estimated that there are somewhere between 55 and say 65 or 70 Indigenous radio stations in the US, which sounds like a lot. But when you think of the fact that there are over 400 federally recognized tribal communities in the US and even more who are not, say, federally recognized, that's a tiny amount of stations, which means that Indigenous radio, doesn't, you know, it needs to grow. It needs to be larger so that those more tribal communities can self-represent. And I just saw the scope of it and the scale of it and the fact that it extended these questions I ask of community radio. How can people from otherwise marginalized groups, which still includes Indigenous groups in the US, self-represent on radio when mainstream channels, which includes, say, public service radio, but also very much commercial radio, you know, fail to provide space for that self-representation. And Indigenous radio in the US, I found all these stations where that was happening. And so I gained a research fellowship to pursue this further. So I got to spend 2 years both in the US and remotely researching this, you know, examples of Indigenous radio.
Excellent. And yes, I was struck by the figure because if you look at the total and then the number of Indigenous stations, it's only really maybe 10% at a generous estimate. So only 10% of tribal communities seem to have their own radio. So why do you think that Indigenous radio is relatively thin on the ground?
Well, that's a question that's always that it's also true of community radio more broadly. So community radio is by far the most underfunded, under-resourced sector in radio provision, community radio stations around the world, or at least the countries I've looked at. And there's a sense of solidarity and common, you know, commonly held values amongst community radio practitioners around the world for this reason, because they're always fighting for funding. They're nonprofit by nature and by license. So many Indigenous communities in the US went through the process of applying for their licenses via the community route, not all of them. And the FCC, which is the kind of policy broadcasting overseer in the US, it seems to me less transparent a process to apply for these licenses. And the licenses themselves seem a little more interchangeable than they are here in the EU, where you have a kind of more defined sense of the three sectors, including community, right? So I feel like what I found is Indigenous communities felt that a community-facing license was their best chance at getting on air. It was also the case that a tribal priority license opportunity emerged over a decade ago, and these again were quite competitive. So I think last I read into this, I think about three were awarded across the country. Hopefully that number has gone up. And certainly there's been a slowly growing focus on Indigenous radio following its kind of community-facing content during COVID, during the start of COVID, I should say. So they've gone a community radio route because I think it's the most accessible route. But that means that they're also broadcasting within the community radio model, which again is under-resourced. So they have to always kind of make sure that they have enough funds to keep going.
Yeah,
Very long
exactly.
answer. I have these
No,
multiple sentence answers for
yeah,
you, John.
absolutely. But it sounds very familiar to the state of community radio in Ireland,
Exactly.
very much the third sector. And obviously, we're hoping in the context of the work of the new media commission that a more secure funding basis will be provided. But to come back then to the question of Indigenous radio in the US, how resilient is radio within Indigenous communities? Obviously, it's a medium that's under pressure from new digital formats. Obviously, radio can be digital as well, but there's obviously the specter of social media there in the background that can weaken the traditional base, for instance, of engagement with radio as we know it.
I mean, it's a little more robust. You have the generational shifts whereby, as here, as many places, younger people are apt to kind of go to social media, TikTok first. And I know from teaching radio here in Leicester that radio as a medium isn't really considered the way you and I may have considered it. I feel like younger people don't see it primarily as a broadcast medium, and that's a bigger question, but it is also the reality. So if you're looking at Indigenous communities, it's still, radio still takes on a prominence that we might not consider it to have outside of those communities, because it provides arguably a lot more. It provides up-to-date local information, local news that is community-facing. It provides first language programming in Indigenous languages. A lot of people, for instance, the research I did on KPRI, which is for the Pala communities out in Southern California. So they include Pala language programming, but the Pala tribe of Indians does not necessarily foreground Pala in their everyday life. Like a lot of Indigenous communities, English is their lingua franca. But yet these stations should still provide that kind of first language programming as part of their remit, but also because they consider that very important for reinforcing the use of that language in everyday life. So I guess what I'm saying, the shorter answer, is that these Indigenous stations do a lot more with less, which of course is a community radio model so often anyway, but they provide services such as this kind of local news provision, but also information on local events. There's a lot more live programming, and I think that's very valuable for people to feel like they are part of the community because they're being spoken to in real time. And that, again, I think that's just a value of radio more generally. So I would say in the examples that I was able to research, so KPRI, KSUT, which is in Southern Colorado, but actually serves the Four Corners area, which is an area rich in Indigenous tribes. So you have the Ute, the Southern Ute tribes, but you also have Navajo or Diné tribes. You have Hopi, all clustered around the Four Corners area. So KSUT would, unlike KPRI, would speak to multiple Indigenous communities, as well as those listening remotely. So Indigenous stations, in a nutshell, do a lot of work with their resources. And now that they can broadcast online to audiences, you know, quite literally around the world, that's more accessible content, but it means that more people are listening. So
very good. So obviously, as you know, I'm very interested in the question of language revitalization, and some of my own research focuses on minority language media, especially in relation to Irish. But to look at the US situation then, how prominent is the Indigenous language in Indigenous radio in general, or does it depend entirely on the community in question? For instance, a large language like Navajo presumably has more programming in the Navajo language, or is there huge variety across the country?
I think there's variety across the country, and like with community radio anyway, there's tendencies you see across stations. So of the stations that I researched and was able to kind of like do a real deep dive into their programming, so that's KWLP in that's the Hualapai station in Northern Arizona, KUYI, which is the Hopi station, again, KSUT, KPRI. I found across that programming that whilst they include first language programming, it is not the primary language still. So it would be kind of linked to a feature of that programming. So for the Hualapai station, you would have, that's KWLP, you would have a word of the day, which they would broadcast over the lunchtime. So the Hualapai, that's their language, word of the day, they broadcast that at lunchtime. I think the Hopi station did that as well. Pala has kind of incorporates Pala language into a music show where the host broadcasts locally produced Pala music from people using Pala traditions and Pala genres of music. And he would like frame that in Pala language. But what's fascinating about these stations, though, and their programming is alongside that first language programming, John, you also have programming that speaks to what community members want to hear. And in so many places, especially across the Southwest, that's reggae and even some hip hop, you know, because radio, it speaks to what locals want to hear. And there's a lot of love out there for reggae, for instance, in what has been called by one of my practitioners as Indian country.
Very interesting. And let's come now to some of that research, because you've written a very interesting article about two stations, one in Colorado, KSUT, as we've said, and then KPRI in California. And the question of ResDub Radio,
yes.
A show called ResDub Radio featuring reggae music comes up in the case of KPRI. Why is reggae music so important to an indigenous community in California?
I mean, I talked to the radio host for that show, Elijah, in some depth, and I'm quoting, or I'm referencing, I should say, the article, which is out. It's published by the Global South in a dedicated issue. So all of this is kind of out there for people to read if they're curious to follow up. It's an open access article. But what Elijah was telling me is just people, you know, as he says, reggae has always been big on the reservation. There's a lot of reggae artists who live and produce music on Pala, for example. So he wants to amplify their work. So it's very much a community, both of musicians producing reggae, but also people who enjoy it. So it's not just the broadcast of reggae music, but it's the community building that builds up around events, say live reggae. At the same time, and this is where the editors, you know, kind of said, hey, so what are you saying about reggae in terms of why, let's expand on why there might be that kind of like real love for reggae more generally. And one argument that I found was that reggae has an appeal politically. You know, it came out of its own kind of decolonizing work in Jamaica, you could argue, yes. In that it amplifies and provides a voice for a political struggle. And that's a commonality that any kind of disenfranchised or otherwise marginalized peoples can share. But then how that comes out, I think, in the texture of radio, and Elijah himself said this, is just, it's not fancy, you know, it's reggae is, it doesn't mean it lacks artistry, it doesn't mean it lacks like real production skills, but what it does have is a kind of like tangibility, a kind of accessibility and a rawness, which is the opposite of like slick and produced. And I think that aesthetic really resonates with people, both just emotionally, like music should do, but also maybe politically as well. So that was my takeaway from stuff I read around this and from what he was saying about his music.
Fascinating. And that brings me on to a related point, which is in your research on KSUT in Colorado, mm-hmm. your collaborator there spoke about how it was important for her not to use radio voices, that not being fake was very important. And this struck me as being a really important question in terms of the perceived authenticity of this type of radio to its listener.
I mean, this is something that is so close to my heart. And so when I was talking to Sheila, that's Sheila Nonato, who co-wrote and co-contributed to this piece, and she is station manager for tribal radio at KSUT. And she did expand on that at quite some length. She just said that she didn't consider herself to have that professionalized radio voice. And you and I, and any of us who listen to or have participated in radio in any way, know exactly what she means. There's a real polish to a kind of radio voice, which by and large, bearing in mind that community radio is very diverse in terms of practices, in terms of habits, even in terms of station style. But there is a kind of, in place of that polished, say, homogenized, I would argue almost globalized delivery, instead there's a real kind of place-based tenor when people speak from and to where they're from, if that doesn't sound too mystical. So what I mean by that is something I've talked about before in stuff I've written earlier around this idea of accented radio. So everyone has an accent. So including me, I have one of the most normative accents on the planet, unfortunately. And that's just because I'm born and raised as a white middle-class Midwestern girl, despite my travels subsequently. But everyone's voice has that accent. And what that accent communicates is not just kind of where you're from, but very much your reference points, your vernacular, your slang. And I think what Sheila's talking about here is she talks about, because she doesn't have a kind of performative glossy or, you know, kind of polished radio voice, she is more accessible and people trust her. And words like trust and intimacy, I think, really apply to radio, especially live radio, especially community radio, because it's important for people to feel spoken to in real time in ways from someone who they trust. And that trust emerges from feeling that person is authentic, and that authenticity emerges from them speaking in a way that is natural to them. And she just broke it down so well. She said, you know, it's not, I can't be fake. If I was fake on air in my community, they just, I wouldn't get any traction. Nobody would listen to me.
Absolutely.
It was me summarizing her.
It's a very important part of the of your argument, I think. And in Ireland, some of those voices will be referred to pejoratively as mid-Atlantic accents, that they're from somewhere in the middle of
the... Yes, I remember this well. Yes, so the D4 accent, indeed.
Absolutely. We could go on another tangent about that. I wanted to come back, Katie, to some of the key concepts in this paper that you've written. You write about the concept of Indigenous internationalization and its relationship to radio. Can you explain to us what you mean by that?
Indigenous internationalism is this concept that I was reading about primarily and initially from the writing of a scholar, an Indigenous scholar called Nick Estes. But the idea, of course, you should never say of course, I think, when you're teaching or on air, because it assumes that everybody has read the same stuff, and we should never assume that. But internationalism has been deployed to kind of communicate a solidarity, right? It's been used in Marxism. It's been used in political movements. So when I think, when I deploy and consider Indigenous internationalism, it is on that basis of a shared sense of being, of indigeneity, being Indigenous.
Yes.
So, and I need to say, too, that I'm always coming to this research into Indigenous radio very much as a settler scholar. I am absolutely on the outside, and I have been privileged throughout that these practitioners will give their time to speak to me, and in Sheila's case, will co-author an article. So I'm not embedded in Indigenous internationalism. But again, following Sheila's insights, the idea for her show and for her programming, for instance, but also for Elijah's with his reggae show, is that music programming, Indigenous music programming, resonates with people from diverse tribes. And that's enormously important politically. It's enormously important culturally, because people from very diverse tribes, all with their own language, all with their own rituals, cultures, habits, practices, can still feel part of a larger indigeneity across, in this case, the US, as part of kind of a politicized body, but they also can come together in events like powwows. You have intertribal powwows scheduled throughout the year, which have now come back now that COVID is still among us, but kind of in a different place. And those powwows embody a kind of Indigenous internationalism, where people are together culturally, but they can also feel part of a larger Indigenousness. And I think I've been told, and I can see why that's important in terms of feeling part of, you know, of Indigenous peoples more broadly, where they're still underrepresented, again, in mainstream and in commercial contexts.
And that brings me to a very important, a very significant sentence, I think, in your paper, when your collaborator said, Sheila said, they've never had to schedule their life to hear their own culture, referring to a majority population. So this brings us to the importance of minority representation in media.
Again, yes. I mean, really, a lot of her perspective that, you know, and what ended up being the two of us contributing to this article came because we were having this conversation, and I can remember it still. And she said about the voices, which just resonated with things I feel very much from a different, you know, place and time. But what she was saying there was so important. Absolutely. And she said it so much better than I could, or, you know, because she's coming from that perspective. So, you know, it's hard to explain, as she said, and I'm reading from this, it's hard to explain to people who have the privilege of just being able to turn on the radio and hear whatever they wanted to hear. So instead, she had to, as she described, she had to wait till this single program of Indigenous music was played once a week for her. And then she would schedule, you know, her time around that program. And I'm glad that you've isolated that, because I feel like that's that does speak to the question of representation and underrepresentation, and therefore for the real need for stations like KSUT, which has all Indigenous programming all the time, Indigenous for Days, as Sheila would say, but also with KPRI, where it's from and for the reservation at a more localized stage, it's still Indigenous programming. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. So can I ask you then, looking ahead, Katie, what do you think are the prospects for Indigenous radio in the US based on your research? Where is it heading in the next 5, 10, 15 years?
Oof. That is probably, in a nutshell, beyond the scope, because I can't break down, because then you talk about things like structures and policies and changes to policy that would give more resources, frankly, to more Indigenous stations. That's what's needed. And I have not tracked that development because those are kind of structural questions. But what I did see as a start towards greater resources for greater representation is that from the beginning of COVID-19, stations such as KUII, the Hopi station, and others as well, because they were all station managers were talking to each other at this time of crisis from mid-March 2020 onwards. And suddenly the very localized live programming they were already providing became that much more urgent and acute, because they were providing information on everything from event closures to safe hours for elders to shop in local stores, to food deliveries, to testing opportunities, to local numbers on the reservation. I mean, it was extraordinary the work that was being done by community stations anyway, but also very much by Indigenous stations, because they were on the ground and they were able to give more accurate information than the deeply resourced deep pockets of, like, not just mainstream radio in the US, but also things like NPR, which were scrambling because they weren't that precisely locally placed. And when I was speaking to somebody from KUII afterwards, I say afterwards, maybe a year later, he was saying that there was a recognition of that really important health provision, health information provision, amongst kind of emotional support that was happening from Indigenous stations. And I think there is a slow recognition of that value, and there may be a kind of pivot toward following that recognition to more money in policy, to more money and resources in policy terms. I don't have the specifics in front of me, but he did say that the amplification of that community facing work has been recognized. It's something COVID, you know, has produced, right? It's kind of suddenly shown a very bright light on what information was needed, how it was being provided, et cetera. And that's across media, right? Not to get too broad about it, but it did provide, I guess, an insight into this important work that perhaps was not as visible before.